This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writers' Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. With everything going on in this country over the last 2 weeks since the midterms, there was also big news from the United Kingdom this week, extremely big news. On Wednesday night, Theresa May came out of her headquarters at 10 Downing Street in London and announced what Britain has been waiting for more than 2 years, a plan for Brexit.
This is a decisive step which enables us to move on and finalize the deal in the days ahead.
May spoke for 2 minutes, light on detail, and through most of it, you can hear a protester shouting in the background.
I know that there will be difficult days ahead. This is a decision which will come under intense scrutiny, and that is entirely as it should be.
Intense scrutiny, it seems, is a British expression that might mean they're going to come for me and they're going to cut my bleeping head off. Then Theresa May went back inside 10 Downing Street, closed the door, and politically speaking, all hell broke loose. Sam Knight has been covering Brexit, and he recently profiled Theresa May for the magazine. We'll be joined in a minute by Rebecca Mead, a longtime staff writer based in London as well. Sam, I don't know how to put this any better, but what just happened?
It's hard to sort of exaggerate the sort of extent of the ferment and the chaos now. The reason this has been so controversial is that from the get-go, Britain announced that there would be a way to not have a border on the island of Ireland between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, despite the fact that Britain would be leaving the EU.
Because the Republic of Ireland is staying in Europe as Britain plans to leave.
And at that point, Theresa May set herself the challenge of how to devise a compromise that could allow that to happen. And the solution that has been arrived at after everyone banging their head against this problem for the last 18 months is that not just Northern Ireland, but the whole of the UK will remain inside the EU's customs union, sort of for the foreseeable future, until someone can come up with a better idea to solve this problem. And that idea of Britain remaining inside one of the EU's key pieces of architecture, following lots of rules, being subject to the jurisdiction of the ECJ, which is the EU's highest court, spells and smells to Brexiteers that we haven't really left and we may never leave. And that is what's causing the chaos today.
So basically the worst of both worlds, right? They would have or would have had all the economic rules and basically no say at all in the process.
Mm. Theresa May's response to that is that we hope that we will never end up in this situation, and once we continue these negotiations in the next unbelievably kind of epic phase of this thing, which is called the transition period, in which negotiations will continue, that we will be able to design something so this thing, which is called the backstop, a sort of insurance policy, never has to arise. But once you see it in black and white on the text, it's hard to get that out of your head and not to feel sort of fatalistic that Britain will sink into this situation, which is, you know, on the face of it, an absurd situation for, you know, Europe's second largest economy to be a rule taker inside, you know, crucial aspects of the European Union with, as you say, you know, no say over them.
Do you see any way forward from here?
So it was really telling to me that on Wednesday evening, when Theresa May stepped out of this extremely long and brutal cabinet meeting to announce that the cabinet had agreed to support the deal, she said for the first time, the country faces a choice now. It faces a choice between my deal, and no Brexit at all. And, you know, as you'll know, and as we've been speaking about, there is this campaign for a people's vote, a second referendum on Brexit, which could, you know, in theory, keep the UK within the European Union. And it was just very striking to me. That's the first time that Theresa May has aired the possibility. That's not because she wants it to happen or she thinks that's a good idea. She's dead set against it and will do everything to stop it happening. And I think in a way she mentioned it to sort of remind Brexiteers and pro-Brexit people to get behind her. Otherwise, this thing is in peril. But I think even raising that possibility has, if you like, it's emboldened everyone across the political spectrum to think that this thing is up for grabs now.
Well, Rebecca, how would you make the case for Brexit? In other words, if you're Boris Johnson at this point, who's still ferociously behind Brexit and not a watered-down version, what is he still advertising as the sure benefits of it to the people of the United Kingdom?
I think the argument that the Brexiteers made from the very beginning before the vote took place was an argument about a kind of vague idea of sovereignty and control over our destiny as a nation. For the voters for whom the contemporary world gave them very little sense of having any control, that was a very appealing argument. The thing that one sort of hears around now from people who are either in favor of Brexit or at this point just think it's going to happen, so we might as well deal, is, you know, yes, things will be a little rough for a while, but it'll all work out fine in the end. Those people making that argument have within their own lives a kind of wiggle room for things to take a downturn. The pity of it is that there are so many people who voted for Brexit who don't have that wiggle room in their own household budget to see food prices go up, for example, as it's anticipated they will, or to see an economic downturn and for wages to stagnate. They don't have the luxury of thinking that's no big deal.
Rebecca, this summer you moved back to London after having lived in New York for 30 years. You must still be seeing the city through fresh eyes, even as you and your family look to settle down. Where do you see the evidence of Brexit in practical life, in conversation, in the overall political anxieties of the United Kingdom now that you live there?
Well, London, where I've been living since the end of August, is a very different place from the rest of the country. London is sort of an island unto itself. It voted overwhelmingly to stay in the European Union. London's stuffed to the gills with Europeans and people from other countries too. It's a very international place. And so when one's here, there's almost a feeling of, how much difference can it really make? There's an absurdity to what's going on here. There's a kind of Alice in Wonderland quality to it, where there's a kind of disbelief about what's going on.
Sam, you've been traveling actually all over the country and getting a sense of how people feel. Is there any shift in the position on Brexit? And outside of London, what are the anxieties about the future?
So I think something that's sort of really easy to lose track of, particularly if you're in London, if you're kind of instinctively think that this is, you know, a terrible idea, it's very easy to lose sight of a fundamental kind of driver behind Brexit, which was a kind of honest, democratic response to a feeling of being governed by remote, alienating forces, be that globalization, be that kind of loosely regulated capitalism, be that the European Union. When you're out and about in the country, there is this kind of strong feeling that Brexit is being handled badly. And what we're seeing now, I think, and in a slightly worrying way, is a kind of betrayal myth emerging. You know, Theresa May is not an avowed Brexiteer. She never sort of has expressed strong views either way on whether Brexit is a good thing or a bad thing for the country. So there's this...
Which is amazing, yeah. Though, isn't it? Isn't it amazing that the prime minister of the country has never expressed a firm view one way or the other on the most consequential question in contemporary history for the United Kingdom? How is that possible?
I think that, you know, Theresa May's kind of strength and weakness as a prime minister is that she's not particularly charismatic. She doesn't paint a rosy vision of what is possible. She is a selfless and dutiful person. And I do think that with the presentation of this Brexit deal, she's almost irrelevant. I feel like this deal represents the reality of Brexit. It's a mess. It's a compromise. The agreements that she's come to will protect the economy. They will make Britain more out of the EU than it was before. But it's an ugly proposition. And so I do think that what's happening now is truly an argument about the substance of how this should proceed rather than her personally.
Rebecca, just as a point of comparison, you've moved back to London. You've been in New York in the United States for a long time. So you've lived in Trump's America, and now you're living in Brexit Britain. And I wonder, how does the feel of it differ or resemble what's going on in the United States? The political discussion, the nature of the anxieties and resentments, the white working class issue, for example.
Well, I mean, I think the difference in atmosphere, I've said this before, but I'll say it here. I think the difference in atmosphere between Britain and the United States is the difference between depression and psychosis. I mean, I think that there's a...
Great.
I think that, you know, my feeling certainly in Trump's America was one of mounting panic every morning when I looked at the news to see what latest, you know, depredation had happened. Here, it's sort of like, oh, God, yet another dreary Brexit negotiation step to try to assimilate and get through. I mean, the thing about Brexit is it's incredibly complicated, incredibly important, and unbelievably dull. And, you know, one can never say that about Trump's America.
I have to say, it sounds like a giant bollocks.
No one says giant bollocks, but it is a
right,
giant bollocks.
I know that that's a
cock up. We would say
yeah,
perhaps.
A giant big cock up. There you yes. go. So everybody's miserable. Nobody's happy. Sam, you just wrote recently about the UK's National Health Service, which is a pillar of British life. NHS has fallen on hard times pretty recently, and Brexit is not making things easier. What kind of threat does Brexit opposed to these kinds of government institutions, these social welfare institutions, which are so important to daily life in Britain?
Yes. I mean, the first one, which is obvious, is that there is a substantial minority. I think it's about 10 to 15% of the workforce of the NHS is made up of EU citizens who come here and deliver people's babies and give their drugs and give them their, you know, their health exams. There's a kind of question mark over their rights and whether they'll want to stay. You know, I think the number of EU midwives coming to the UK has fallen like something like 85% in the last year, you know, so there'll be a real felt effect in staff shortages across the NHS. And then there is, you know, the larger question of how we pay for these things. I mean, the NHS is a strange one because it's so totemic. The government's focused an enormous amount of kind of energy and funding on trying to keep it going, while actually lesser seen aspects of the welfare state are sort of withering on the vine a bit at the moment.
So if I live in Middle England, which is part of the heart of the pro-Brexit vote, how am I going to be satisfied by Brexit? How is my life going to be better, or am I bound to be disappointed?
I mean, Brexit is one of these sort of awful things posited as a solution. You know, it just can't be the solution. I sometimes kind of sort of grapple around for sort of analogies that sound a bit like this. But imagine if for one reason or another, you know, the American people were offered a referendum on whether or not to return to the gold standard, right? And you had a kind of huge national campaign in which people sort of put forward essentially a kind of nostalgic version of life when, you know, men mm-hmm. were men and a dollar was a dollar and, you know, a pound of apples in the shops was a pound of apples in the shops. Do you know what I mean? And then and the country voted, actually, you know, the return to the gold standard would actually make life more reasonable and more real and more kind of approachable and people would look each other in the eye again, you know what I mean? That kind of thing. That's what we've done. We've done this arcane policy idea of, as Rebecca said earlier, you know, a few group of people basically obsessed with British sovereignty, as if that will solve things like more fulfilling, better skilled jobs for, you know, the white working classes of the Midlands, which it just is not able to deliver. You know, that's a very negative account of what Brexit is, and I sometimes kind of try and draw back from that and say, look, the EU is a very, very complicated political project, and I sort of have to hold on to this idea that people who voted for Brexit, they didn't do it from nowhere. You know, they did do it because there is something alarming about a group of, you know, and this is the Brexit rhetoric, unelected EU commissioners in charge of trillion-dollar budgets in Brussels making rules about, you know, British milk. You know, that can be a kind of an alienating way in which to take part in democratic life. So this is the sort of the yin and the yang in my head all the time about Brexit, is that it will not improve people's living standards. But were they wrong to send a message that they're not being listened to? That's the two sides of it.
But as with the Trump vote, yes, there was a genuine cry of pain from the white working class voter on both sides of the Atlantic. But there was also racism and ignorance and a kind of anti-elitism and all these other factors that played in. The decision may end up having these profound economic consequences for many years to come. A lot of people thought that what they were voting on was immigration, yeah. Right? And a sense of wanting to close up Britain's borders, which was a sort of an uglier part of the conversation. And that, too, is something that we're going to have to continue to reckon with.
What an astonishing mess. Rebecca and Sam, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Rebecca Mead and Sam Knight, both staff writers based in the UK, which is still part of Europe, for now. More in a minute. Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The trial of Joaquin Guzman Loera began this week in New York. Known better as El Chapo, Guzman was regarded once as the biggest trafficker in the entire drug business, and Forbes called him one of the most powerful men in the world, full stop. El Chapo had twice before escaped from Mexican prisons, the second time through a tunnel that his henchmen dug right under his cell. And after that, Mexico finally agreed to extradite him to the United States for trial. He faces 17 counts related to drugs and firearms, and prosecutors intend to tie him to more than 30 murders. Convicting a cartel boss is no easy feat, but the government has two star witnesses, two Americans, major drug traffickers who worked very closely with the Sinaloa cartel and became federal informants. Patrick Radden Keefe has covered the drug war for years. And Patrick, who are these guys, these witnesses?
So they're a pair of identical twins from Chicago, Pedro and Margarito Flores. They're Mexican-American. They're born in the U.S. and actually grew up on the West Side. It's funny, you know, I've been writing about the drug trade for years, but there's this one aspect of the business that always remained kind of stubbornly mysterious to me. We all know about these big drug cartels in Mexico. I've written about them for the magazine. And we know they import huge amounts of cocaine, heroin, marijuana, methamphetamine to the United States. And we're also probably familiar with the idea that there's a retail drug market here where people buy these drugs. You have mental images, maybe because you watch The Wire, or maybe because you buy pot from time to time.
I take the Fifth Amendment on that.
No accusation intended. But the one thing I've always been curious about is, where do those two worlds intersect? Where do they meet? Who are the middlemen who actually negotiate with the big suppliers who deal in kilos in Mexico and the street corner dealers who deal in grams here in the United States?
And these guys are the middlemen in some way?
Yes. So they actually grew up in a family where their father, who was an immigrant from Mexico, had dabbled in the drug trade himself. But by their early 20s, they'd really gone into the business in a big way. And what they were wholesalers. They would negotiate directly with Mexican cartels to buy just enormous volumes of drugs.
What kind of volume, what kind of money are we talking about?
Literally tons of drugs. They imported tons and tons of cocaine to the United States, but also dealing in heroin and marijuana.
And why were they so successful?
Well, there are a few things that are required in order to do this. You need the kind of comfort level with people on both sides of the border. You need to be able to interact with people in Mexico, but also people here. The other thing you need to be able to do, which is really interesting, is buy these drugs on consignment, on credit, because nobody puts down cash on the barrel for that volume of narcotics.
No kidding. That's the way you buy drugs, is on consignment?
All based on trust.
What kind of trust can there be in that world?
Oh, there's a great deal of trust when unwritten contracts are enforceable with death. Part of what made them so successful is there's a great deal of betrayal in the underworld. But these guys were twins. They were brothers. They were incredibly close. They could finish each other's sentences. And so this allowed them to really be a unit, and they would never double-cross one another. Margarito was kind of more outgoing. He was sort of the relationships guy. Pedro was the logistics manager. But they worked very closely together, and they could kind of communicate in shorthand. The trust between them was unshakable.
So what you had is the front guy, the people guy, and the systems guy.
Absolutely, like in a business.
That's amazing.
And the other thing about them that distinguished them was that they weren't violent. They were never violent. You remember that line from the famous line from The Godfather about how violence is bad for business? They really internalized this to a kind of astonishing degree.
Wait. They were basically drug lords, and yet they were of the nonviolent variety?
Yeah. Working for very violent organizations, buying their drugs. I'll give you an example. So at a certain point, one of the twins is actually kidnapped. Pedro is kidnapped by a rival in Chicago and held for ransom. And Margarito just pays a ransom of over $1 million to get him released. They had a rough idea of who it was who had done this, but did they go out and seek revenge? No. Would have been bad for business. They just accepted the loss and kept moving. So I'd always heard about the Flores twins, but I'd never really known a great deal about them. And then just recently, a guy named Tom Shakeshaft, who was a federal prosecutor in Chicago who had brought some really major cases against the Sinaloa drug cartel, retired. And he agreed to come in and talk with me about the Flores twins. And he told me that they were really just kids. They were born in 1981. At the height of their power, they were still in their mid-20s. Yet they became a kind of indispensable bottleneck.
Flores brothers were moving so much quantity of drugs and were making enough money that customers needed them worse than they needed any particular customer. And so they would just cut them off.
The twins were thriving in Chicago, but eventually they got indicted in the U.S. And here's where their cultural fluency on both sides of the border really helped them. What they did is they just moved to Mexico and relocated their operations and started essentially running their Chicago business remotely from down in Mexico. And that worked out pretty well until 2008, when their main supplier, the Sinaloa cartel, began to fracture.
The Sinaloa cartel was part of what been referred to as the Federation, which included a number of cartel leaders who were working together. And that at some point, there was a split within the Federation. Well, the Flores brothers were being supplied by two different cartels within the Federation. And when those two different cartels went to war with one another, the Flores brothers were put in a very tenuous position of getting an ultimatum from each side that the Flores brothers were to work only with that side or else.
But this really sounds like The Godfather, doesn't it, Patrick? I mean, you have a split in what's called the Federation, and the brothers have to decide what to do. Who do they go with?
Exactly. It was an impossible situation. It turns out, however, there was a third option. They let it be known through a lawyer who was working for them that they might be willing to cut a deal with the U.S. government. In other words, the Flores twins were going to flip. So Sheikh Shaft and a few of his colleagues traveled down to Mexico to debrief the twins and see if they were serious about actually coming over to the other side in the drug war. And this wasn't as simple as it sounds. The Sinaloa cartel is famous for having corrupted parts of the Mexican government. It's part of the reason Chapo Guzman, the head of the cartel, managed to stay at large for so many years. So when Sheikh Shaft and his team went down to Mexico to meet their potential informants, they had to do it in secret. They couldn't tip off the cartel that they were down there meeting with these guys, but they also couldn't tip off the government.
That was one of the more James Bondian experiences I've ever had, because I got picked up in an armor-plated Jeep at the airport and driven to a hotel. And then the next day we went to the U.S. consulate and then got driven around the streets of Monterey at about 110 miles an hour to make sure that nobody was following us and nobody knew where we were going. And we ended up going into the basement of a Western hotel in Monterey and taken up to a secure floor in that hotel with a lot of agents and other U.S. government personnel who had been there to make sure that it was a safe place to meet.
And this kind of cloak and dagger stuff might be normal for a DEA agent, but Sheikh Shaft was just a lawyer.
Well, when I started in the U.S. Attorney's Office, I was still single. And this case all came along sort of just after I'd gotten married and just after I'd had my first kid. And the stakes go up when all of a sudden it's not just you. There are other people relying on you.
Sure.
And I wrote a letter to my wife, and it was sort of explaining two things. One was the usual things you would say about, you know, that you love her and that kind of thing. The second, though, was trying to explain why I went. Because I had started this, I felt like it was my responsibility to go. And that, number two, that if I sort of chickened out of going at that stage, she wouldn't want to be with me anyway, because I'd be pretty miserable for having blinked in the eye of being personally nervous or scared about doing my job.
Sheikh Shaft and his colleagues were gathered in the hotel room when Pedro Flores walked in without his brother. He would be negotiating for both of them.
They were largely inseparable in the sense of they had been in this together from the outset. And it is my belief that if only one of them had wanted to cooperate, neither of them would have.
Pedro was slight, soft-spoken, a guy who would blend easily into a crowd. But as he started talking about the brothers' operation, Sheikh Shaft was stunned.
His initial description of the structure of his organization, and the volume of drugs that they were distributing on a monthly basis was jaw-dropping.
The brothers agreed to help Sheikh Shaft and his colleagues in exchange for lenient treatment when it came to their own crimes. So while they were still in Mexico, what they did is they started making phone calls, negotiating deals with the cartel, and recording them. And because of their position in the cartel as these major figures, these wholesale buyers, there was no one they couldn't get to. On November 15th, 2008, Pedro placed a call to Chapo Guzman himself. You got to understand, at that time, Chapo was the most wanted drug trafficker on the planet. There were no recent photos of him. People couldn't say for sure what he looked like. He was a rumor, a ghost. But Pedro just dialed him up. Suddenly, here was his voice saying, "Amigo, how's your brother?"
No soy ningún traficante, decía el Chapo Guzmán.
I would say that once they decided to cooperate, they became as good a cooperators as they had been drug traffickers when they were on the other side.
Remember, the Flores brothers were supposed to be the biggest drug wholesalers in Chicago. So in order to keep up appearances, they had to continue importing drugs. And as the drugs arrived in Chicago, the feds would just happen to do a raid and seize them, which put the twins in a dicey situation.
And if you're seizing them, no money's coming back, right? There are no customers.
So you're taking the consignment, and they have no way to
pay for it. And that's one of the reasons that this couldn't go on longer. I mean, when we—
Because they're going into debt.
Right. And to people who expect to get paid.
To put it mildly.
Yes. On time.
Hold on a second, Patrick. Let me get this straight. The Flores twins are already in a very tricky position. The cartels had gone to war with each other. Each one is demanding that the twins choose sides. The brothers decide to keep doing business with both cartels, running the risk of alienating either one, while tipping off the U.S. government and recording phone calls with extremely dangerous men. What made them so gutsy?
Well, it's interesting. Tom Shakeshaft said that it was partially guts, but it was also that they were very calculating.
There were some practical reasons that they did all of that. One is that they are smart guys, and they knew that if the government was to prosecute these folks, corroboration is the name of the game for a trial lawyer. And among the best corroboration that we can have when we try a case is real-time intercepted phone calls and conversations with the defendants as they are currently engaged in their drug trafficking activity.
For you guys who were working this from the government side, there must have been a conversation where on the one hand you're thinking, boy, this is such great stuff, and on the other hand you're thinking we'd better pull them out if we ever want them to be alive long enough to testify. Was that a negotiation or?
That was my concern all along, and because if they didn't survive and didn't make it back to the United States, you've got no case against anybody. Those conversations, those recorded conversations become much more difficult to authenticate at trial. You don't have live bodies to tell you the story. So there's a tension there between wanting to leave them in place as long as you can while you're continuing to get this good stuff, while at the same time constantly being cognizant of the danger involved and knowing that at the drop of a hat, you may need to say, let's go. It's time to get them out.
That happened on November 30th, 2008, less than a month after Shakeshaft and the DEA started working with them.
It was a Sunday, and I learned three things simultaneously. One was a big shipment, a big payment was due to the Sinaloa cartel that day or the next day on the order of somewhere between $4 and $6 million. I also learned that DEA was planning on perhaps searching and or seizing some warehouses in Los Angeles. I became concerned that if on the same day the cartel didn't get paid and they had one or more of their warehouses raided, it raised the specter that the Flores brothers, rightly or wrongly, could get blamed for it.
So you realize this is going to happen. This is going to go down the next day. So was there? So there must have been great urgency in terms of.
We got them on the phone, DA and I, and we told them, "Pack your stuff. We're getting you out of there in 2 hours."
Jeez, what happened once they got back to the United States?
So once the twins got back to Chicago, Shakeshaft knew that word would spread pretty quickly that they had betrayed the cartel. But they still had time to catch some of the buyers in the United States. So the brothers start doing the same thing, making phone calls. But this time, they're calling a bunch of their customers to arrange deliveries and sting operations. If you're imagining guys with guns pulling up in bleak industrial zones, that's not usually how it works. In the real world, a surprising number of drug deals happen at mundane places, like McDonald's or the parking lot of a mini mall.
You do this job long enough and you realize how much drug trafficking takes place in front of all of us all the time. I mean, I've had, you know, it's funny. I'll drive by a mall where I am familiar with the picture of the Best Buy because I prosecuted somebody who routinely, you know, it doesn't take much to deliver, say, 10 kilos of cocaine. It's a duffel bag. It moves from one trunk to another.
Eventually, word does get out that the brothers have flipped. And when it did, the threat of vengeance from the cartel, from all the people that they had betrayed, was so real that it got to the point where even their lawyers, so not the brothers themselves, but the lawyers for the Flores twins, requested anonymity, asking that their names appear nowhere in any of the public records associated with their case. all the Flores brothers' relatives have been told to stay in the U.S. where they could be protected by U.S. authorities and really never to go back to Mexico. But their father, interestingly, Margarito Sr., the guy who taught them the drug trade when they were growing up, he reportedly was really upset when he heard that they had turned on the cartel. He was really disgusted and didn't speak with them again. And eventually, he did go back to Mexico. It appears he may have had another family there, and he went down to visit them.
While he was there, he was abducted. A note was left on his car that conveyed that his abduction was related to the brothers' cooperation.
The note said, "Shut up, or we'll send you his head."
It was a little bit of like your worst anxieties coming true, in the sense that they could get to somebody.
The twins' father's body was never found, and he's never been heard from since. Shigshaft had no idea how the brothers would react.
That was morning. I just walked in and I said to them, I'm the prosecutor and you guys are the witnesses, but when something like this happens, we're all human, and today you can do whatever you want to do. I said, if you want to talk about him, you can. I said, the only thing I can't let you do is just talk, the two of you. Somebody has to be here. You know, an agent has to be here monitoring you. They were visibly distraught at both what evidently had happened to their dad and the fact that they had played a role in that happening.
Did it discourage them from cooperating?
It certainly did not discourage them from continuing to do what they were doing. And in fact, that same day, we continued to work. So,
was that their decision?
Yes.
So at a certain point, they said, let's get back to work.
Yeah.
And even as they were cooperating with Shakeshaft, out on the streets, the Flores brothers were being replaced in the drug-dealing chain of command.
I think it stands to reason. Common sense tells you there are still drugs available in the city of Chicago. I'm not so naive as to think that it maybe even made much of a dent in the overall war on drugs. I think we played a role. I think it was a good case. In 2008, probably the wholesale value of a kilo of cocaine was about somewhere between $20,000 and $25,000. It went up after the Flores brothers were arrested. Today it's 35.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Because it actually made it harder to – it was a scarcer commodity just by virtue of taking them off the street.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of factors behind it. I don't know that it was just them, but they certainly played a role.
Unbelievable. What's going to happen to the Flores brothers now?
Well, they've been serving out their sentences in a federal prison, but in witness relocation, so we don't know where they are. And they are actually going to emerge pretty soon because this week Chapo Guzman went on trial in Brooklyn. So he did get extradited in the end to the United States, and he's now going to face this trial. And it's a huge trial. It's unprecedented security. They've had to shut down Brooklyn Bridge as they bring Chapo back and forth for some of the preliminary hearings. And in fact, the identities of the jurors have been held secret. This was a big fight, but it was decided that this guy is so dangerous that they couldn't try him in a situation where he might ever find out the identities of any of the jurors. And so their names have been sealed. And in fact, the prosecution has also kept as a closely guarded secret the identities of the witnesses against Chapo Guzman. But just recently, some of those names have come out, and reportedly, two of the star witnesses against him are Pedro and Margarito Flores. So one of these days, quite soon, they will walk into a Brooklyn courtroom and face down Chapo Guzman, this guy they worked with for so many years, and talk about what they know of him and his criminal empire. And it seems pretty likely that on the strength of that testimony and of other cooperators who've turned on Chapo and are working with the government, Chapo is probably going to go down. He's probably going to go away to prison for the rest of his life. And when that happens, the Flores brothers will go back to prison, serve out the rest of their sentences, which is just a few years at this point, and then they'll enter witness protection. And the really interesting thing about this, Tom Shakeshaft told me, is that he thinks that if these guys go into witness protection, they can survive as long as they follow the rules. And these are the rules that the Marshal Service has for when you go into witness relocation. But one of those rules is that they would have to be separated. The brothers couldn't be in the same place. They'd have to be in a different city. They'd probably have to be in different states. And there's a real question about whether or not they'd be able to abide by that. So you might have this amazing irony, which is that the fact that the brothers had been inseparable in their criminal career, this thing that had made them so successful, might eventually end up being precisely what cost them their lives.
Patrick Radden-Keefe is a staff writer at The New Yorker, and we heard from Tom Shakeshaft, a former federal prosecutor now in private practice in Chicago. The trial of Joaquin Guzman Loera, El Chapo, started earlier this month in New York. Coming up in a minute, The New Yorker's Kelly Fasane walks us through the love-hate relationship between Christianity and rock and roll.
You just can't take away the church.
It's the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. I'm David Remnick. Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Kelly Fasane knows more music and more about music than just about anyone I know. He's written for us about everyone from George Strait to Paul Simon to Gucci Mane to King Crimson. Kelly is absolutely full of surprises in the best way. Okay, you recently had a piece in the magazine about Christian rock, and no pun intended, it was a revelation to me.
Oh, thank you.
And what was amazing is how soon it started. I knew, you know, a fair amount about the way gospel had been drawn upon to become soul and R&B in the tradition of Sam Cooke or Aretha Franklin. But the way it came into rock and roll, is a history I don't think that we know quite as well.
Now, obviously, a lot of people making rock music over the years have been Christian one way or another. But what starts, a lot of people say it starts in 1969 with this album called Upon This Rock by Larry Norman, is you get what I would call intentionally Christian rock. In other words, you have someone, part of what he's trying to do is make an album about Christianity, calling people to Christianity, educating people about Christianity. And he's kind of associated with the Jesus movement, which is this kind of hippie Christian revival that's taking place around the same time. And whereas at the beginning he seems like a real anomaly when he first comes out, by the 70s, he seems like the godfather of what is this growing genre of Christian rock. There's the so-called Christian Woodstock in 1972 in Dallas called Explo 72. One of the headliners is Larry Norman, but another of the headliners is Billy Graham.
I'm assuming Billy Graham was there to preach, not to sing.
Billy Graham did not sing.
Yeah.
But these things in the 70s kind of merge, a Christian rock and the mainstream of American Christianity, so that by the end of the decade, a lot of mainstream pastors, a lot of big churches have embraced Christian rock. One of the great Christian rock artists to come out of the 1970s is this guy, Phil Kagi, who was in a band called Glass Harp and then goes solo. You might know of him, David, because he's a guitar shredder. And I know you are also a guitar shredder.
Absolutely.
Should we listen to a little?
Absolutely. What's the song?
The song is called Time. It's from his 1976 album, Love Broke Through. This is a live version from 1977.
Headed towards Styx country here.
Well, yeah, and this is what a lot of these bands do, is they draw from all the secular stuff that's going on.
Right.
And you know, it's interesting, a lot of the stress and the anxiety in this world of Christian rock is about the lyrics, right? And how should we praise the Lord, and how frequently, and how explicitly, and how much Jesus needs to be in there. Kagi kind of gets away with something different because he's a guitarist and some of his songs are instrumentals, you know, he does incredible acoustic finger picking records, and he can really shred. And obviously when he's shredding, you know, it could, he could be shredding to, in the service of anything.
There he is. He's up in the stratosphere. He's on the 19th fret here. Okay.
And again, you know, the lyrics of the song are about how the Lord's going to come back and you're running out of time, brother. And so there's a certain severity in the words, but the music is much more joyful.
Who else is a favorite, Kay?
So this is Leslie Phillips.
Rings that I can't trace, pull my heart away from love I long to taste. Why do I run away when I can face to face with anything I need?
She's not that well known, but she's a little better known by the name she used later in her career, which was Sam Phillips. So in the 1980s, as Leslie Phillips, she released a series of Christian rock albums or Christian pop albums. She was sometimes promoted as the Christian Cyndi Lauper.
A little Alanis Morissette thing going on.
Yeah, although this is before that. This is from 1987. This album's called The Turning. It was the last album she made as Leslie Phillips. It was also produced by someone who wasn't well known then, which is T-Bone Burnett. And they ended up getting married.
Are these bands playing at the same places that everybody else is playing it, or are they playing mainly at big churches?
That's a good question. Sometimes they are playing regular clubs, but also they have their own circuit. And financially, there's a lot of money in this circuit. There's big festivals, there's big churches, and churches are eager to raise money to bring these bands in.
So there was big money in it, too.
Yeah, there's always been big money in Christian rock music. Partly, I think, my theory is that it's partly because there were often parents willing to buy their kids Christian rock albums and buy their kids tickets to go see Christian rock music.
To keep them on the up and up.
Yeah, so it was kind of subsidized. So for Christian rock, there often was this sense that the lyrics are what matters. And as long as you're singing about God, the music can really sound like anything. And for some artists, this meant, oh, we're just going to take whatever the popular styles are and kind of remake those songs with God lyrics, and it's going to be not that good. But some other bands realized, like, oh, this is going to give us license to do all sorts of stuff. Like, we can stay in this world and make really crazy noise.
Like Christian punk?
As long as the lyrics are right. So this is a band called Extol from Norway, whose first gig was in a church outside Oslo in 1994. The song is called Celestial Completion.
Had a little lute recorder thing going, and then all of a sudden
they fooled you, didn't they? This is
headbangers. Weren't you in a band like this?
I was not in a but it might be a little hard to hear without the lyric sheet. But right now they're actually singing Matthew chapter 25 verse 23. Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. And so
that's coming through my headphone. I can't hear.
Absolutely. And so they're a great example of, if you really believe this idea that the lyrics are what makes something Christian, Christian rock could mean a whole lot of things.
But the religion is sincere. I mean, nobody's doubting the sincerity of it.
Oh, I mean, you know, there's always doubters, but yes, absolutely. A band like Extol, which is, you know, had a long career and yes, stayed in this world.
Amazing. Amazing. Amazing.
And then, so this is a band that's been one of my favorite bands, actually, for a while. They're called Me Without You. They come out of the sort of post-hardcore scene in Philadelphia, formed around 2000. They put out their first album in 2002 on Tooth & Nail, which is a kind of, very influential Christian kind of punk and alternative label.
This about eternal non-existence at the end. A stranger's face appeared. They say he lost his mind, or too much found his mind. I hear it all the time. Vibrations rose in waves from a sea of.
over the years, a lot of Christian rock kind of became very mainstream, became very popular. Me Without You sort of brings the tradition back to its countercultural roots. The lead singer was famously a dumpster diver, and they ended up drawing in all sorts of things, not just Christian traditions, but Sufi traditions, Baha'i traditions. But so they're a band that's actually been influential on a lot of Christian bands, again, showing that this tradition can be a big and capacious tradition.
So Christian rock has stayed alive and thriving now for almost the length of rock and roll itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And depending on how you define it, right, you could look at bands like The Killers and Imagine Dragons, which both have Mormon lead singers, Paramore, even Katy Perry come out of the Christian rock and Christian pop world. So there really is a wide number of different kinds of Christian rock music, and oftentimes people are listening to it even when they don't know they are.
And the nights my heart was tired, you sang your saccharine song, but when your mouth was quiet, was the sweetest sound of all.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Souls will leave this age behind, for streets of solid gold, I hear it all.
Kelifasane.
On a West Virginia road.
You can find his article about Christian rock at NewYorker.com. I'm David Remnick, and that's almost it for today. If you're traveling this week for the holiday, good luck to you. And if you're cooking, best of luck and a stiff, stiff drink. We're going to leave you now with a few timely words from my friend and colleague, Adam Gopnik. Adam's been writing for the magazine since 1986, and more than once, he's written about turkeys. Here's Adam.
The best way to prepare a turkey is a somewhat occult, mysterious, and even in its own way esoteric answer. It's like a Zen answer. Because the truth is, there is no good way to prepare a turkey, my son. There is no good way to prepare a turkey. I have bought French turkeys, and I have bought American turkeys. I have bought heirloom turkeys, and I have bought supermarket turkeys. I have brined turkeys. I have basted turkeys. I have pre-basted turkeys. I have dry-brined turkeys. And after you roast it, either at a very high heat or at a very low heat, after all of that process, it ends up tasting like turkey. The famous thing, of course, is that Benjamin Franklin wanted to make the turkey the national bird of America because it seemed emblematic of everything American. It is a wild American bird. It is homely. It is somewhat domestic. It isn't a predator like the damn bald eagle. So all of those things, I think, make it attractive to us. The core myth of Thanksgiving, after all, is attractive one. It's a myth of diversity. It's a myth of coexistence. One of my, I almost say, a myth of intersectionality. All myths elide a lot of unpleasantness. No myth known to man does not elide a lot of unpleasantness, whether it's the rape of Europa by the bull or the idea that the Indians were glad that they had sat down to dinner with the pilgrims, that I think they came much to regret it. But the thing about a myth is not that it elides reality, but that it encompasses some other kind of ideal. And that ideal, I think, is still a positive and living one. I remember in the years when we lived down in Soho, we would go to Ottaminelli's, the butcher there, and everybody's name would be written up in black crayon on brown paper who had a turkey, and then they would click it off one by one. And seeing that wealth, predictable wealth of immigrant names, from bizarre Ashkenazi names like mine to Ottaminelli and the Italian and Asian and every kind, deeply moving. It's a holiday of many kinds. It really is a celebration of diversity and bad poultry. We have hosted Thanksgiving every year for 36 years. Usually, I insist on doing most of the feast myself. It does tend to rest on the principle of the marshmallow. The more everything tastes like a marshmallow, the more Thanksgiving it is. And very heavy on starches and sweets. My daughter, Olivia, has gone off to college, and so this will be her first Thanksgiving back. She has been texting me with pictures of sweet potato casseroles. I'm not exactly sure why. It's not part of our tradition, but I think someone probably in her dorm was passing around sweet potato pictures, which is what they do these days since kids no longer have sex, apparently, in their 20s. They share casserole pictures on Pinterest. And the idea of a feast is clearly just one of the three or four deepest things in human beings. I don't think there's any culture anywhere in the world that doesn't have dancing, music, and feasting. At least as a super amateur anthropologist, I've never read about any where those aren't essential rites and rituals. We are a culture where dancing is very formalized now or hived off. We don't typically stop the meal to dance. We love music, but most of our music is secondhand. It's stuff we listen to on recordings. It's rare for someone to say, let's lead some Gilbert and Sullivan songs. Feasting is the one common ritual that we all have. But I have known people who hate Christmas. I've known that, and I know countless people who never want to celebrate their birthdays. And I have passed 4th of Julys with people who are scarcely aware that it's the 4th of July, and certainly May Days, and who even knows when Arbor Day and Columbus Day fall anymore. I have never known someone who was allergic to Thanksgiving. So Thanksgiving may be the universal solvent of Scrooges. You know, we wonder if there had been an American Christmas Carol, it certainly would have been set at Thanksgiving rather than at Christmas, and would have involved, you know, some kind of J.P. Morgan type being persuaded by Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman to cease being an evil person and become good and eat a turkey. That's actually not a bad idea. I may don't broadcast that. I may do it.
That's Adam Gopnik. Please, don't steal his intellectual property. And have a great holiday.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.